My name is Owen Thompson, the Local Journalism Initiative. This interview is with Marcus Pekonen of the Routes of Change Nonprofit Society. For the last 8 years, Pekonen has traveled the world with no motor. He has sailed through the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean with just a sail, biked through mountains, and even pogo stick. His journey for Routes of Change ended on the 8th of July with a walkathon through the city of Toronto, where he started 8 years younger. He was joined by friends and family who saw him off 8 years prior. On this voyage, he survived flesh-eating bacteria and broken ribs with zero-emission travel. Even though his journey is over, he hopes that someone will one day pick up the mantle for Routes of Change. Okay, so it has been about 8 years since you left off on your round-the-trip voyage, or round-the-world voyage, rather. So from the start of your journey to the end of your journey, what has been the, I guess, biggest change for you personally?
Oh, that's a tough question to answer, and I don't know really the answer to that one. I guess the biggest change is that I'm 8 years older. I don't feel like a 30-year-old anymore. I mean, that's not true, actually. I still feel like I'm 20 years old, but my body does not feel like that. So, yeah, I guess that's a big change for me.
All right. Well, I'll let you think about that question as we go on, and I'll come back to it towards the end. So, okay. What made you want to go on this voyage and the way you've done it, especially?
I came up with the idea when I was fighting forest fires in British Columbia. And I had done that work for a number of years. For a long time, I had actually worked seasonally in British Columbia. And then I would travel down to Central and South America, where I could live quite comfortably on a small budget. And, I started seeing how my purchase choices in Canada and just my life in Canada were affecting communities all over the world. There's a number of different things that influenced me. I was just sort of attempting to be more of the change that I wanted to see in the world, like Gandhi. but I got to a point where I didn't feel like that was enough. And part of my inspiration came from reading this book actually called Blessed Unrest. And it just inspired me to know that there were people all over the world who were not giving up on our species and the health of this planet. And it inspired me to get more involved in environmental and social activism. But at the same time, I had no interest in working in an office doing that sort of work. And so I basically was figuring out how I could combine what I am passionate about and create my dream job. It was right at that time at the end of a fire season that my dad called me up and said he had 2 weeks to live. If he didn't do some serious chemo, he would die. On my way home to see him on a plane, the irony is not lost on me, I formulated this Routes of Change plan. And it was basically came from the question, what would I want to be doing with my life if I found out that I was going to die in 2 weeks? How could I be living my life with no regrets? The Roots of Change project was my answer to that question. And my dad ended up surviving another 6 months, but then passed. Right before he passed, he was able to meet my niece who had been born 2 weeks before. My other sister had also just become sober after a long battle with drugs and alcohol. And all of these things combined made me think about my impact on the future and what I was doing with my life. And so I just sort of started working towards this dream of mine. Went back to school for documentary filmmaking and started looking for a budget for a film, because that's how I figured I would make this into my job and make a film out of it and get a budget that way. But that did not come easily. And eventually it wasn't until 7 years later that I finally grew up the courage to just start the journey with very little financial backing and support. Yeah, I just went for it. Hoped it would work out.
How long ago, because you brought up your father's unfortunate passing. If you don't mind me asking, when did that happen?
That was in 2009. So it was, yeah, ways back.
This brings me to, I guess, my next question of why zero emissions? Why no motors?
Well, so I wanted to, as part of the main mission of the journey, is to highlight and raise support for other local non-governmental grassroots environmental and social justice organizations. And in doing that, I mean, often their battles are against these big corporations, often oil and gas corporations, who are destroying their land and their environment. And so I figured I should, I limit my support of these corporations and doing what I do instead of flying around the world or taking helicopters around the world. That I figured I would just draw my line of support in the sand at that point and just not use motors. Of course, I'm not blind to the fact that much of our world functions in some way thanks to motors, but I think we have an exaggerated view of how we need to rely on them. I think we've forgotten that it wasn't long ago that we survived quite happily and healthily without them. Yeah, I just figured I would limit my support of these corporations in raising support for these environmental organizations and social justice organizations. And so I also just really love a good adventure, and I really love being athletic outdoors. And so that mission of not using motors lends itself very well to what I'm also passionate about. And yeah, and I figured, if I do something big and crazy, big challenge, I should be able to find the support to make it happen and be able to get some attention to support these other organizations.
After, I guess, 8 years of motorless transportation, what's the hardest part about it, about doing that?
The hardest part is the fact that the world is no longer designed to move around without motors. Highways and roads and border crossings and bureaucracy are all sort of up against me. I, for the first few years of the journey, I would have nightmares that I would wake up in a motorized vehicle. They weren't frequent nightmares, but common enough that it was concerning, because I obviously could not let go of the fear of, messing up my mission. And one of my biggest concerns was that bureaucracy somewhere along the way would force me into a vehicle just because they can, and they like to use their power to express their dominance over you at times. But that never happened, thankfully. I did have a lot of challenges at border crossings. Of course, I'm doing something that these people who have the power to say no would prefer to say no, as opposed to feel responsible for the death of a foreigner in their territory. But thankfully, I had a friend who was, right before I started the journey, he was elected to as a member of parliament, and he wrote me a letter that sort of helped to soothe government's concerns around the world. It was sort of like my get out of jail free card. It wasn't, I never did get in jail, but it did help me cross borders here and there. Basically said that I was not just some crazy lunatic out on a mission to kill himself. I actually had a purpose and the support of my community back home, and basically put the responsibility less on these people and more on my own government and my own community. So that was nice to have. But yeah, I mean, one of the hardest things was definitely just cycling on the roads there, because humans have become so used to driving around in these cars. We have lost our fear. We forget that they are an extremely dangerous thing to be whizzing around on. They're still like one of the number one killers on the planet. And when you're on a bicycle next to them, you're putting your life in the hands of complete strangers all the time, who may or may not be focusing on the road. They might be texting, or they may be intoxicated. And I always had to sort of accept that my death was very close when I was on a road or highway. In addition to that, Asia was quite depressing with the amount of pollution. Not even just in the highways, but when you get into the mountains in the Himalayas, there's still smog up there because of all the industry in India. The thought that I had of this journey and traveling through national park to national park and breathing in fresh air as I was outside traveling was, a bit optimistic. I ended up sort of, you know, breathing in a lot of road dust and black exhaust from cars and just air pollution in Asia and in other parts of the world as well. So
you left North America in 2016, just checking the map here. Yeah, April 23rd, 2016. Getting across the ocean motorless seems a little difficult. So how exactly did you go about that?
Well, yeah, when I first started the trip, I didn't know how I was going to get across the ocean. I figured I would crew on a sailboat or something like that. And then a few weeks into the trip, back in July of, or I guess it was August of 2015, a friend of a friend called me up and said he was up for sailing with me to Hawaii. He had a 30-foot boat and he needed some help getting to Hawaii. So I met him in San Francisco about 9 months later, and we sailed together as a 25-day sail to Hawaii from San Francisco. And then he lent me the boat and I sailed it solo the rest of the way, most of the rest of the way across the Pacific Ocean. You know, sailing, I always felt way safer in the middle of the ocean on a sailboat than I did on highways, because when I'm out there, my life is in my own hands and I'm quite comfortable and confident that I can hold on to the boat. You know, I avoid hurricanes, which is a big danger, and I'm capable taking down a sail. And it's actually not as complicated as it may seem to most people, and not as dangerous. You know, a lot of people have fear of the unknown, so they just don't know what it's like to be out there. But having been there and knowing what it's like, it's definitely, it can be very scary. I'm not gonna, you know, lay that down. It can be extremely scary, but in the end, as long as you hold on, like, most of these boats are designed to weather hurricanes, and I never even came close to weathering a hurricane. Most of my fear in sailing across the oceans came from just getting in and out of harbors and ports and close to land, because I wasn't using a motor. These harbors and these ports are not necessarily designed for people who are not using motors anymore. And there's also, you know, there's a wide array of different boats around, and some of them are, well, most of them are way more expensive than the boats that I was sailing. And so if I were to hit one, or, you know, it would potentially end my trip, because I can't afford to pay for these boats, and I can't afford to pay for even the own boat that I was on. So a lot of stress there, because you also just don't know what the winds are going to do when you're close to land and close to buildings that may change the wind direction. And so there's a lot of sort of unknown factors there. I had to be really safe and really patient and just get as much local knowledge as possible, but it was always a bit scary, and that caused most of my stress and anxiety in regards to sailing.
How many nautical miles did you sail overall?
I believe it was around 23,000 nautical miles. Yeah, so that first boat, I gave it back to the owner in Hong Kong, and then I was mostly on bicycle, but a few other kayak boats and random fishing boats through Asia. I got stuck in COVID in India, and then eventually got a 27-foot boat to myself in the south of India, and I sailed that across the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean.
So in your journey, I guess, what has is there a specific locale that kind of you look back on as one of the most beautiful settings you've ever seen?
Before this journey, I was living in Tofino, and I started the trip in Toronto and then made my west across Canada back to Tofino. And having been around the world, there's actually nowhere in the world that I would rather live. I love Tofino, and that's probably one of the most beautiful places I've been. Outside of that, Hawaii was a very pleasant surprise. When I first landed on the Big Island of Hawaii, the energy of that place was just magical. It really is the land of rainbows. There's always rainbows, and they have an interesting array of climates because of the giant volcanoes. You can get snow up on the volcanoes, and it was a pretty special place. And then, yeah, sailing through Micronesia was for sure one of the more beautiful places I've been on the world, but I was not of great health, so it wasn't as magical for me. I was suffering from this flesh-eating bacteria that sort of migrated through my system, and took a few months for it to finally heal.
Did you get a lot of those traveling the world, like diseases? Like, you don't really hear too often about people getting flesh-eating bacteria while traveling.
No, not a lot. Yeah. No, that was bad luck. And I think it actually had to do with sleeping on a bed that had black mold under it. So my immune system just got weakened. And then I took the wrong antibiotics multiple times. And finally just my immune system, I think, got better and I was able to fight it off. But, stomach illnesses here and there in several countries, but nothing too serious outside of that. I broke my rib in Indonesia surfing a big wave. Just the impact on the water actually broke my rib. There's been a lot of absolutely beautiful places. I can't really pinpoint one of the most or my favorite. Northern Vietnam was really magical for me, but a lot of these places, they're so beautiful, but what really makes them is the people. You can find beautiful places all over the world, but it's the people that you meet that really, for me, define a country and a place. And thankfully, it seems like in every single country I've been to, I've met wonderful people who have just opened up their doors and their hearts and welcomed me like family. So.
Is English your only language?
Well, I speak Spanish, but I didn't go to any Spanish-speaking countries on this journey.
So was there any difficulty with language barriers and communication?
100%. Yeah, language barriers in Asia are pretty challenging. Although, there's pretty much in every town now somebody speaks English or at least a few words in English, so you can get by. But also with these apps, Google Translate and these other apps, you can sort of get by and have conversations with that help. But I also, in every country I went to, I at least attempted to learn basic conversations. How to ask for water and food and say thank you and hello, my name is. And so I'd say I learned how to do that in, I don't know, at least eight languages. I don't remember them now, but it's challenging in Asia because there's these small countries. They often only give you a 30-day visa, and then you're in a new country and that country's speaking a completely different language. Whereas I had traveled a lot in South and Central America previous to this trip, and it's pretty much all Spanish. So you learn Spanish, which is an easy language to learn, and you can communicate with, the vast majority of the people there. Not the case in Asia. Even in India, it's this giant country, and people think that, most people speak Hindi or English, but there's, hundreds of different languages, and it's not easy.
Bringing back to India, actually, you said you were stuck in India due to COVID. How long were you there for?
I was in India over a year, almost a year and a half in total, including the time that I went into Nepal in between. My first lockdown, I actually was locked down in the north of India in a town called Rishikesh. And 2 days before the COVID lockdown, I met a girl. So it was actually pretty wonderful timing. I was already planning on going up to an ashram and doing some yoga and meditating and editing videos for the YouTube vlog. I wasn't able to get up into the mountains. Instead I was stuck in this town called Rishikesh, which actually is famous all over the world for yoga teacher training, and as the place where the Beatles went to their ashram in India. It's a pretty wonderful place. It's right where the Ganges comes out of the Himalaya Mountains, and there was a community of peaceful yogis from all over the world there to spend the first 8 months of COVID with. So it was actually, this pretty lovely experience for me, and it was a much more social time than I was used to quite a while on the journey. So. And then also thanks to COVID, I was able to find my sailboat because an Australian, young 21-year-old, I think, had sailed the boat from England and arrived in India just as COVID hit, gone home to Australia. And so his boat was just racking up expenses sitting at a marina, and he was happy to sell it to me for quite cheap. And that's how I managed to, when the first lockdown lifted up, I did a, I think it was like a 3,000 kilometer bicycle through COVID in the middle of, or through India in the middle of COVID, and got to the boat, spent 4 months fixing it up, working on it, and then sailed away right before the like sort of more serious second wave hit India. from there, I sort of just lucked out with the countries I went to. Seychelles had no restrictions because they were the most vaccinated country in the world. Tanzania was the next country I went to, and their president had denied the existence of it altogether. And then South Africa, they were completely relaxed about it and welcoming also. So that sort of got me close towards the end of the COVID times.
Yeah, you touched on it there for a second. How lonely is it to travel the world by yourself?
I haven't always been by myself. I have had friends join me for parts of the journey, and I'm actually very comfortable being alone, especially when I'm, planning to go out to sea and be alone. I'm prepared for it, mentally prepared for it, and quite capable at entertaining myself. And I do have some entertainment out there. I can read books and listen to audiobooks and listen to music and stuff. And I'm comfortable just staring at the ocean. But
Let me rephrase the
yeah.
question a little. I guess how isolating is it?
Isolating? I'm sure that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think it depends from country to country. The times when I feel the most lonely is when I get into a city and people don't recognize my presence. They don't say hello. They don't even acknowledge my existence. And that's you think you get to a city and you're going to be social and meet friends and stuff, but people in cities are just generally less welcoming and less friendly to strangers. And that's not the case when you get into the countryside. Everybody wants to know who you are and curious about you, and you make friends and family. So, and in many of the countries I went to, being alone was a challenging thing to actually find time to your own. I mean, when you're actually traveling, when I'm traveling during the day, I'm definitely alone on the bicycle or on the sailboat, but the second I stop, I would be surrounded by new friends, and even though I was exhausted, I would end up having conversations.
One of the big things that I think a lot of people do traveling for is trying new foods. Where what stop did you have where you thought that like this is like the best food I've ever had?
Oh, I mean that's such a hard it's just a hard thing to say. I mean, I love Indian food. I had eaten lots of Indian food before I went to India, and it was just lovely to have it easily accessible all the time and experience some new flavors as well. I think one of the more pleasant surprises was Malaysia and the food there. So they sort of have what do they call it? I don't know, like the tricultural experience in India. So there's the Malays, the Chinese, and the Indians. They sort of make up the majority of the country. And so those three combinations of foods come together in a melting pot at times, or separate. They're all very delicious. Sometimes crazy spicy, but not all the time.
Let's run back to the return home. So you got into North America around Florida. So by then it was this
Yeah, it was
year,
this year.
you March 13th. So after, I guess at this point, 7 years, what was, I guess, the biggest adjustment or change you had to make coming back to North America?
Biggest change was by far the having to pay attention to how much things cost. I cannot afford to live in North America with my budget. Annual budget has been under $20,000, and so I spent, more than a quarter of that in my first couple months or my first month in the United States, just because the Canadian dollar exchange rate was really bad too, and so I didn't even notice that. And it's not like I'm throwing money away, but just buying food was enough to spend all my budget, and that was a shock. For sure, food prices have risen. Cost of living has risen, and that's the biggest change. Outside of that, it's been pretty normal.
Just very quickly, well, like, so you spent a lot of your money in the first couple of months of being back in North America. Let's compare that to India, because you stayed there, I guess, the longest. In terms of the cost of living, like how different is it compared to North America?
It's vastly different. I mean, I can survive on, if I wanted to, $5 a day in India, and that's eating three meals out and maybe even finding a place to stay. I mean, $5 is maybe pushing it. $10 comfortably, get a room and three meals. you know, in the States, that's you're lucky if you can do that for $200 now. It's a big difference.
So rounding back to the end of your journey, what was going through your mind during that final stretch of the your massive walkathon?
One of my favorite things about traveling and living this dream is that I'm able to very easily drop into the present moment and just live by my instinct in the present. And that's like it's one of the reasons why I love to travel more than anything. I don't have to have stress about future plans or the past, and I can just wake up in the morning and decide to go one way or the other. It's a very sort of freeing, liberating sensation. As I approached the end of this journey, I was still able to maintain that sense of living in the present moment. And because of that, I didn't really have any expectations, or was dwelling on how I would feel or what I would do or like what it would be like to get to the end of the journey. I knew it was going to be extremely emotional seeing all my friends and family who I hadn't seen in 8 years. I didn't know how that emotion was going to express itself, and I didn't know how I was going to feel. But you know, Saturday was sort of a blur. I felt very surreal. By the end of the day, my cheekbones were really sore from like smiling all the time, and it just didn't really feel real to me. It was a very bizarre feeling. Yeah, when the emotion did hit, I mean, the emotion had hit me before, even just when I crossed the border into Canada. I started crying at the border, and I wasn't even seeing any friends or family there. So Saturday was almost just so overwhelming that I you know, it was hard to even let the emotion out because it was so intense. I was at a loss of words, and yeah, it was wonderful. I said at the final party, for me, I'd always been thinking that the first step of this journey is way more important to me than the last step, because the ending and accomplishing this goal was, I had sort of accepted that that was less important than just living the goal and being in the moment in it. But at the same time, it was one of the most important moments of the whole journey, not because I finished the journey, but because I was with my loved ones and so many friends and family for the first time in so long. Like that made the end that much more important than any other time on the journey.
So before we finish off and we part ways, I want to round it back to my first starting question. What has been the biggest change for you since you started this journey?
About halfway through the journey, I was in Malaysia, and I went to Vipassana Meditation Center, where you learn the technique that Buddha taught to his students. And it's a form of meditation that I never knew existed. And it was very suitable for the way I meditate. It's in you, the only way you can learn it is by sitting and meditating silently for almost 10 days. Through that process, I was really able to let go of any concern for future and just really accept everything in my life. And so I'd say, knowing that, and I went back and did it again 8 months later, another 10-day silent meditation retreat. And knowing that this form of meditation exists, I feel like I have a retirement plan. I feel like I don't need anything at all in my life but to sit and meditate in order to be happy. And so I would say that that is the biggest change that I've come, is I'm just way more accepting of everything. That's how I find true freedom right now.
That's all of my questions. Do you have any final comments you would like to leave off on?
Well, yeah, I would like to let your listeners know that the journey is over for me, but I do hope to continue working with the Roots of Change organization. And I'm working on a film, and all the profits from the film will go to the organizations that I've connected with. But in addition to that, I'm actually starting to search for somebody to continue the Roots of Change journey in their own style, but just basically staying true to the no motored